Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined from Cape Town by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Glad to say it's gloriously sunny, so full of the joys of spring for the moment. I'm never sure how long that lasts.
Yeah, up here in Joburg, it's actually very sort of cloudy today. It's we've had a little sprinkling of the first spring rains, which is quite nice, although I hope that often if we get early rain, it seems like we don't get that much rain. So hopefully we do get a little bit more rain. And of course, also in Joburg, Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you?
Good, good. It's, I don't know. It's another exciting news week.
Yes, it is. Much is afoot in this fair land we call our home. And the first is a story that I missed yesterday, but Gabriel brought it to my attention, and it is hilarious. So as we all know, the ANC is having some, shall we say, issues with human resources, namely that it hasn't been paying its staff for many months. For 3 months. And this has gotten more interesting because the ANC staff have received help from what some might expect to be an unlikely source, which is, of course, the Democratic Alliance. The DA on Tuesday laid a charge against the ANC over the ruling party's alleged failure to pay unemployment insurance fund contributions to the state. One of their claims is that the ANC has been deducting UIF contributions from workers, but since 2018 has failed to pay it over. DA MPs Michael Carter and Michael Bagram said, if true, this would constitute a criminal offense in terms of the Unemployment Insurance Contributions Act of 2002 and the Tax Administrations Act of 2011. As a ruling party, the ANC has a special duty to serve as an exemplar to other employees. And as the ANC is being accused of criminal behavior by its own staff members, the matter requires urgent investigation by SAPS. The DA says that the ANC owes apparently 18 million rand in PAYE contributions, which of course I think was what kicked off this whole mess to begin with, is that the ANC suddenly had to pay all of these contributions from its tax contributions and then got into massive financial problems. So, Gabriel, let's start with you. It really does seem like the wheels have just all of a sudden completely fallen off the ANC. They were looking very wobbly for a very long time. But, you know, when something's wobbly for a very long time, you start to think, oh, maybe it will never fall off. And then all of a sudden it all did.
Yeah, no, I think this is hilarious. I mean, I imagine if you tell anyone that's not South African, here's what's happening. The opposition party is suing the ruling party to get the ruling party to pay back its taxes for its staff's pensions. No one's people are going to think this is the start of a very convoluted plot about upsy downsy, topsy turvy politics. Okay, but it's actually happening, and it is hilarious, and it is, as you say, Nicholas, a kind of lifting of the outer skin of the corpse, and then you see inside little maggots crawling around. It smells terrible. And there's a gross side to it too. There's a really harsh human interest side to this too. I think that there is something amazing about the ANC staff who for months carried on going to work, who didn't go on strike until after the election deadline for candidate nominations, who were sweating long hours and missioning away to try and get names onto the list, and are just being kicked in the teeth by their party. I saw an interview with the DA leader, John Steenhuisen, where he said he was trying to be sort of avoid smiling, I think, about the sort of political opportunity here and trying to make the serious side of the case for why to do this. And one of the points there was, beyond just the interest of the ANC members, think about every private company out there that's watching this. The message is clear if the ANC doesn't get punished, that you don't have to pay your taxes if you don't feel like it, and you're friends with the inside track guys. I think that's very dangerous. It doesn't mean that people will just be able to give up doing it, because not every company is being run by an insider. But it will mean that kleptocratic, nepotistic, rainbow oligopoly cartel, color-coded crony capitalist entities that are very close to the corridors of power will give up on following the rule of law. And some of these laws are good. For example, the law that says, if you withhold part of my salary to put into a pension fund, then you actually have to put it in the pension fund. That's a good law. They're not breaking some kind of technicality here. It's a very good law that you're not allowed to take my money from me to put it in a pension and then put it in your own pocket. That's definitely stealing. And the laws against stealing are definitely good. So when the ruling party is openly breaking those laws and being accused of that at the very least by its own staff, I think it is important to step up. SAPS doesn't seem to have done it. So good on the DA for taking the opportunity. It feels like one of those moments where a smaller political party, I'm thinking Action SA, I'm thinking COPE, I'm thinking whatever the other ones were, if they were quicker, they might have gotten there first, and that might have been good for them. But mostly this is good for the country, and it's good for those staff members.
Indeed. I must say, we find ourselves in a very wacky place of late. Unfortunately, there are people being screwed around in a very real way by this. But perhaps maybe the ANC is just trialing the destruction of property rights on its own staff first, before it spreads it to the rest of the country.
Communism at home first, and then
yeah, it's like the sort of Stalinist program, right? Aren't the ANC still influenced by Stalinists? It makes sense. Michael, your thoughts on this? Many people have made the point that, you know, businesses are constantly gone after by COSATU and the ANC for allegedly treating their workers like garbage and not paying them properly and all this sort of thing. And, well, it seems like the pot was calling the kettle black or whatever.
Exactly. I think it's exactly right, and everything Gabriel said is right on. You know, when you think that the country is really being held together by relatively small but determinedly hardworking, law-abiding, to use the dreadful word, cadre of people. I mean, it's a very big one. It's the middle classes, the dutiful workers who get to work every morning on time, do their job, pay their taxes, abide by the laws. This is a slap in the face to them, you know, and it's just really shocking. I mean, it's very funny, but it's also, as Gabriel says, it's a serious issue. And so good for the DA to use this strategy to draw attention to it and to demonstrate what it means to hold people to account.
And one almost feels like, considering all the legal problems the ANC is having these days, that there should be lawyers who train specializing in defending the ANC in court, because they'll never run out of work until the party falls apart. Gabriel, let me go on to you for the last point on this. So someone is asking here in the comments, if the ANC was suddenly made to cough up all the money, would they be able to afford contesting the upcoming elections? And I guess the sort of broader question here is, you know, we know the elections are now going ahead in October. Do you think this is really badly going to hurt their campaign? I mean, it kind of looks like it, but do you think they'll be able to pull it together at the last minute?
Yeah, I mean, so by the way, I think that's another important reason for the DA to go lay a charge at the Cape Town Central Police Station, is that the temptation must be so great to tell staff members, look, we haven't paid you for 3 months. We'll pay you like a month or two. We're definitely not going to make these UIF contributions. We'll get to that afterwards. Right now, we need to use all the money we can to pay for campaigning. Now, if that's illegal, then you can't do it. And if you're doing it without the staff's permission, then you definitely can't do it. If the ANC had the money, presumably it would have spent the money on staff salaries. It's hard to see it holding on to many reserves while not spending staff salaries. That being said, the ANC must have some reserves. What it's doing right now is selling off assets, according to it, and collecting money through a sort of widespread fundraising campaign. We have very little idea of how successful either of those have been. Although if you put your toe in Twitter, it seems like the sort of put 20 Rand in the jar campaign has not gone very well. Most people's response has been, well, why doesn't Zweli Mkhize give some of the sports cars back first? And maybe I'll give you 20 Rand. Okay. But the he has a worrying thing is the ANC selling off of its assets. I hope that those sales are scrutinized as they ought to be, because the problem is not that people don't want to give the ANC money. People have been giving the ANC money for generations, okay? And certainly for the last 15 years, big time. They spent R1 billion on the 2016 local government election. That wasn't hard for them to do. Thing is, people don't want anyone else to know that they're giving the ANC money. On the back of all the revelations we've had of what it's like to be financially in bed with the ANC, that's understandable. You'll be investigated, basically, or at the very least, credibly suspected. So instead of giving the ANC money or gifts in kind, what might happen is you buy an asset from the ANC that's worth 10 and you buy it at 20. So it's worth 10 million, you buy it at 20 million or whatever it is. And then that way you're effectively giving a free 10 million to the ANC, unless someone can kind of figure out that there's been this effect of money laundering. That's a classic way for money laundering to go. So I don't know that that's happening. I'm just saying that this is the kind of thing that one expects to happen wherever you have the set of problems that we have here. And so there ought to be scrutiny there. We'll have to see, and maybe that segues us to the next question, what the state of play is really in the upcoming elections, given the IEC's moves.
Indeed. And so with that delicate segue, a certain Mr. Gabriel Krauser from the Institute of Race Relations put out a media statement this morning. It's a good chap. I've heard of him before. Saying that the IRR is, as part of its Save the Vote project, is considering going back to the Constitutional Court to, oppose the reopening of candidate lists that the IEC has decided to do. It looks like maybe simply as a means of bailing out the ANC from the consequences of its staff problems. Gabriel, can you tell us about what you were...
Yeah, so let's just remember the IEC wanted to completely burn the deadline and have the election sometime to next year, maybe, if we've got community immunity, whatever that is.
In February, COVID permitting.
Once COVID goes extinct, then we'll have an election. Okay, that was basically what the substance of their appeal asked for. Concord said no. So then the IEC and the Concord said, as we have said at the IRR, look, you did a terrible thing between Dlamini Zuma and the IEC. You proclaimed the election early, which meant that there wasn't a promised registration weekend. You have to go back and let the people register that were promised to get a chance to register. And this is for poor, you know, this is for people like me. I registered on a voter registration weekend. I probably could have gone online and done that if that had been an option at a time. This is really meant for like meat and potato voters. And the court gave quite clearly worded instructions about how to go about doing this. INC said, well, we're going to just start the whole process over and reopen the candidate nominations. Even though it said to the Concord several times that we can never do that. We can't reopen or extend the candidate nominations at all and still have an election before the deadline because it's practically impossible. So they told the court it's practically impossible. Now they're saying they can do it easily. Sounds a little bit like they lied to the court, unless they've discovered a new invention in how to make elections work really well in the last few days that I'm not aware of. I look forward to learning. The argument that's been made by the IEC and alluded to by Cyril Ramaphosa in the media has been that here's this terrible situation we envisage. Ramaphosa says Section 19.3 of the Constitution gives an inextricable link between the right to vote and the right to run for office. You have the right to do both if you're a citizen. But now, he says, the problem is the court is opening up the right to register to vote, but keeping the right to get yourself on the candidate list closed. So the court is breaking the link. The court can't be breaking the link. Therefore, if you open the one, you must open both. Okay, that's the argument. That's definitely not what the court orders. The court was given the option. It was asked, can you extend the deadline by the EFF? They said, no extending the deadline on the candidates. Just reopen the one. So if the court says it's fine, why should it not be fine? Well, this is what we're told. Imagine someone turned 18 on the 24th of August. Okay? So now they can register to vote on the 18th and 19th of September. But they can't be on the candidate list because that closed on the 23rd of August. So there's going to be someone out there who has a right to vote and who can even vote, but who doesn't have a right to be on the list that he's voting for. Now you're breaking the link. Therefore, if we reopen the voters roll, we have to reopen the candidates list. This is the argument. Now, Nicholas is laughing because it's crazy, but to give you a sense of how crazy it is, it's crazier than I thought. So one point is, by the way, if you're really worried about that, then the IEC could say anywhere that someone has showed up and is 18 years old and is wants to be on the list and registers now and like has only turned 18 within this narrow window or whatever. Okay, we can make an exception for them. They can be put on the list. So the list stays the same. And if the ANC wants to stuff its 90 missing ballots with 18-year-olds, then we can really see how serious they are and how seriously the people take them. But it's even crazier than that, because as Nicholas told me, and I confirmed this by going onto the IEC's website and by checking out the annexure to the Structures Act, Municipal Structures Act, I think it was, might have been the Electoral Act, you can register when you're 16. So you can only vote when you're 18, but you can register when you're 16. So if you were like, I want to be on the ballot in October, but I'm only turning 18 in like late August, and that's going to be after, you know, that's going to be like in this danger zone, you could have registered while you were 17. You could have even registered while you were 16 to be on the voters roll, firstly. Secondly, you could have registered in July and August. 20,000 people almost registered online. Now, you can't expect every South African to register online, which is why we had to reopen the voters roll. Some South Africans don't have transport money. Some South Africans don't have data money. And like it or not, and I like it, we must stand up for those people's rights to vote. That is our duty. That's what it means to be a classical liberal, amongst other things. But it's a completely different story pleading poverty to be a candidate on a voter's roll, on a candidate's list. There, the law already says you have to pay a few thousand rand to be on the list. There's no pleading poverty for that. You can't spend 2,500 rand to be on the list and then say, I don't have 5 rand to put data to go and like scan in my ID card. Or I don't have 12 rand to catch a taxi to go to the municipal office to go and register myself there. And you can't say that I'm not informed, that I didn't know, which is the other excuse that you can apply to ordinary South Africans. Because if you're trying to be a candidate, then you must be so involved in the process that you do know that you had these options. So the IEC's thing is, it's ridiculous on the legal issues, which I haven't gotten into. It's ridiculous on the practicalities. It's going out there and saying, we are going to burn the whole process that we've had so far so that some imaginary 18-year-old, whose name we can't even tell you, we don't even have an example of this 18-year-old, just some figment of an 18-year-old, gets a chance to be on a candidate list. And I have asked quite a few councillors, the number of 18-year-olds that there have ever been on a candidate list is almost impossible to know. But it seems that that's in part because it's so very, very low. But for them, for the figments of our own imagination, we're going to start the process de novo. It's crazy. It must be opposed. The DA has already filed papers to oppose. The IRR is in conversation with its legal team looking to file papers to oppose if it's necessary. The IEC was given until today to respond in court papers. So we'll see what they have to say, and then we'll make that judgment call of whether we're needed to help fight this thing. If it does go through, it will not be fair.
Yeah.
If the IEC's appeal does go through, it will not be fair.
I'm just trying to think if I ever met a councillor who was 18. I think the youngest I've ever heard of was a sort of 20-year-old councillor. But yeah, it's not. It's so ridiculous. And so, in light of that ridiculousness, Michael, I mean, it really feels like the IEC is just a kind of grabbing whatever argument it would come up with in 5 minutes written on a napkin before it faced the cameras to justify this decision, which kind of, you know, leads us to the question, if we can't really trust the IEC when running elections, that's going to have some profound implications, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is grave. And, you know, especially in circumstances where the, you know, the irony is the ANC's lapses in the preparation for the election and following the very clearly understood route that Gabriel has set out, and which the ANC, which the IEC is now prepared to make room for and to allow the ANC to correct, are in fact as perfect a reflection you could get of the governance lapses which impose so heavily on millions of people in their daily lives. It's really a reflection of exactly the same thing. And this will inescapably reflect very poorly on the independence and integrity of the IEC. And that's a penalty that the country will pay. It's not simply an internal institutional penance that's being at risk here. It's something that, you know, all South Africans will be burdened by. So it is a grave issue, and this also, you know, it's quite interesting. Just last evening, the reports, the Business Live report about Jesse Duarte appearing to backtrack on the ANC's initial assertion that it was technical glitches which were to blame for the party's failure to submit its candidates list, and she appeared to set out a process which showed, you know, just ineptitude and doing things too late and not doing things properly. So that really underscores all the points that Gabriel has made. You know, this is not an inexcusable circumstance, and there appear to be no grounds for making this special leeway for the ANC.
Definitely. All right, let us move on to our next story, which is about taxis. So anyone who has driven on South Africa's roads, or many people who do not have a car and have to travel around South Africa's roads, public transport, are very familiar, of course, with the taxi industry. And the city of Cape Town has launched a project called, I think, the Blue Dot Project, to try and change the way that taxis interact, perhaps with their customers and with road users in general. And as part of this study, they wanted to kind of work out a baseline for the quality of driving by taxis, the service they were providing for customers, and also how other road users saw them. So studying more than 700 minibus taxis, they found that on average there were 26 daily speeding and harsh driving incidents. The data was collected in June as part of working out sort of where we're at currently. An average of 12,000 harsh driving incidents, that's braking, acceleration, cornering per day, were also detected in June. And I think it amounts to something like a significant number of problems for every single taxi was
right
in sort of like 20.
Yeah, so if I could just jump in on the numbers there, I think it was 5,000 incidents per day of speeding,
yes,
out of 700 taxis.
Correct.
So you can do a small little mathematical, and it's like 7 speeding incidents per day per taxi, somewhere around there. That'll give you 4,900. And then 12,000 harsh braking moments. So in terms of the Discovery Vitality program, I don't think...
Yeah, their premiums would be quite high. And on top of that, they also asked 7,700 customers and 6,000 other road users to rate taxis. And apparently about half of these rated services as very bad to bad. And the top issues identified were dangerous driving, unsafe lane changes, and unsafe stopping. Well, that seems to be pretty much, I think, what anyone who's actually been on South Africa's roads is very familiar with. This is not news to us. But it's quite an interesting project, because it says that basically the attempt here is to kind of change behavior in the taxi industry. The Cape Town government is going to give them driving and service training, as well as incentive payments for good behavior. Michael, what do you make of this?
I mean, potentially, I think it's a very positive start, you know, getting a sense of what the problem is, getting the buy-in from taxi drivers and operators, and involving the people who use the taxi. I think, it's a potentially a good basis on which to build some kind of program. Just before I talk about taxis in particular, it just struck me this term harsh driving tickles me pink. And I think of all the contributions that South Africa has made to the Oxford Dictionary of World English. And I think harsh driving has got to be something that I hope gets taken up. It really strikes me. But it is, you know, it's how people often experience driving alongside or near taxis and in them. Is that it's a kind of harsh environment. Potentially, I think it looks as though the Western Cape government has kind of looked at this quite carefully. The idea of incentive payments is intriguing. We don't really have any idea of how that works and the quantum of cash that could be given as a reward. But it's kind of a real world solution rather than all the other highfalutin ideas that possibly just sail right past the operators and the drivers. Here is something very direct. If you behave well, you know, here's an incentive. I mean, the figures are quite shocking, but as you say, not really surprising. And I thought it's worth just mentioning also that we in fact commissioned quite a substantial report last year, I think March last year, by Ivo Fechter on the taxi industry. And it's certainly worth, if you're interested, go to the IRR website, irr.org.za, and have a look at it, because it incorporates a lot of key things about the taxi industry. One is that millions of people depend on it. So it's not something that we would, in fact, even wish to see go away, because it does provide an essential service to millions of people. It arose in the late years of apartheid and addressed some of the very grave deficiencies in spatial planning that we inherited from apartheid. And yet it does have all these problems. And just recently in Cape Town, of course, we had a taxi war that claimed, I think, upwards of 20 lives over a number of weeks. So we're really conscious of the problems, and particularly from the point of view of taxi users. I think that's really where the focus ought to be. And Ivo makes the point, I mean, one of the points he makes, which is quite interesting, is that the whole taxi industry is, as he puts it, an excellent case study of how a free market spontaneously provides for the needs of millions of customers, even when they're poor and even in difficult circumstances. So there really is something there to work with. And the question is, you know, how do we go about that? And I certainly hope that this Blue Dot project does, you know, show a way to make improvements that, you know, register in the lives of daily commuters. Potentially very, very positive. And we just hope that it does bear fruit.
Gabriel, what do you make of the scheme? I agree completely with Michael. Taxis are really part of our DNA. And it would be nice to have the industry work better for customers and for other people who drive.
Yeah, no, that's a must. I'm always surprised when taxis aren't as good in Cape Town as, well, when there's taxi issues in Cape Town, because I spent most of my taxi riding life in Joburg. First time I got in a taxi, it had a side gear shift, sort of like where the indicator is on a car, and he couldn't shift the gears without also turning the steering wheel. Steering wheel was a pliers.
I've been in a very similar experience.
Whereas in Cape Town, in Cape Town, often the taxis had two operators, so the driver and then the guy who takes the change and gives you change and advertises the thing. They were always cleaner in my limited experience. I only lived there for 6 months. So I don't know. I think it's exciting. I think it's really cool. I do, as I said to you guys beforehand, think that it's terribly painful. There's a painful irony in the English language, which is that the word taxi and the word tax are right next to each other in the dictionary. But in South Africa, they're very far apart in all other ways. I do think that it's a wonderful industry, but that it needs to be legitimized. And that means getting things. It means giving things. It means sort of playing the same game that we all have to play. And that's a piecemeal step-by-step process. It's not going to all be roses tomorrow. And building that trust is important. So that's my final thing. But I'm not going to let the show go without saying a shout-out to the Daily Friend commenters today, especially those who are outraged at the idea of a vaccine mandate. I myself am opposed to the vaccine passport idea, and you can see that in the Sunday Times. But we had a columnist who made a contribution the other way, and we elicited a very exciting response. And I think it's pretty exciting to have such excitement. It's like a cappuccino in my day.
I quite agree. But I must just ask you, you don't have gauchis in Joburg? The gauchi, the gauchi.
Is that what? No. Yeah. No, in Joburg, you've got to open the door yourself then hope that you can figure out how to close it before the thing's gone away. And if you go there with R100, I've been dropped off in a very awkward situation for trying to pay a taxi guy with R100 notes. And he was like, I'm driving this thing. I don't have change for you. Get out right now. I was like, it's late. I'm going over there. He's like, get out. In Cape Town, they got the extra guy.
Yeah. The indispensable part. And they, you know, they, as the taxi stops, they hop out and they shout the destination.
Yeah, they tell you where you're Mowbray.
And they often also assist with a bit of traffic control as well. They'll stick a hand out of the window to stop you. You know, we're coming this way now. So it's, yeah.
No, it's so exciting. And then sometimes they even play music. Yeah.
No, exactly. In Joburg, as our tech guy, Alex says, responsibility is press ganged onto someone in the passenger seat. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the show. Please support the IRR. Please check out the dailyfriend.co.za for opinion, news, analysis, and all that good stuff. And we'll see you
and fight
tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. And fight, yes. Cheers, everyone.